I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS. This October, the most important week in bluegrass returns to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Be part of IBMA World of Bluegrass October 20th through the 24th for 5 unforgettable days of live music, networking, and family fun. Join thousands of bluegrass artists and fans for the IBMA Business Conference, IBMA Bluegrass Ramble, IBMA Bluegrass Music Awards, and IBMA Bluegrass Live Festival. Get your tickets, see the lineup, and start planning your week at worldofbluegrass.org.
Hi, and welcome to The Working Songwriter, the show where today's best songwriters come to talk shop. I'm your host, Joe Pug. Each episode here, we host a distinguished guest, and we ask them to go deep on their inspiration, on their process, on the general ups and downs of making a life in music. So, whether you're a grizzled veteran collecting $25,000 vintage guitars, or else a scrappy upstart, just trying to purchase a single made-in-China Epiphone. This is your show, because ultimately, it is what every writer seeks most, an ironclad excuse to put off actually writing. Hey everyone, it's the first Friday of August, 2026, and I thank you for being here. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. I'm old enough to remember when you had to pay somebody called a web developer to get a website made. It would always be some guy named Benny who drove a Hellcat with an aftermarket sound system and who was always trying to sell you Quaaludes, even though those haven't been a thing since the 90s. And old Benny would charge you $1,000 for a website that would be obsolete in 6 months. But it's the future now. You guys, that's not how it works anymore. We're allowed to have nice things now. One of those nice things is Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. Everything you need is already built in. Music players, images, text bio, video embeds, a gig calendar, press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 per month, and the Working Songwriter podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. Then use the promo code TWSEPK to get 10% off the first year of any new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code TWSEPK. Finally, if you enjoy this podcast, if you'd like to help it remain a viable endeavor for me, here's a couple things that you could do to help. First, you could become a subscriber to The Vault. What is The Vault? The Vault is a private, members-only section of my website that hosts every single episode of The Working Songwriter ever recorded. Currently, only the latest 100 episodes are available in the iTunes Store and Spotify for free. All of the previous episodes are there in The Vault. Additionally, The Vault has every single album I've ever recorded. Not all of them are on Spotify anymore. There's also an archive of the iconic Enthusiast Digest newsletter there. Go to joepugmusic.com/vault. Become a subscriber today. It's about the price of a nice cup of coffee every month. So would you consider buying me a nice cup of coffee and, for your generosity, receiving access to all that content? If you're not in a place where you can contribute in that way, I totally understand. There's still a couple ways that you could help us out for free. First, you could leave us a rating in the iTunes store, or second, you could simply tell a friend about the show. Spread the word about the show. The simple math on those two things is that they will help me much more than they will be a pain in the ass for you. Okay, I'll end all the harassment there. I hope that you enjoy this week's episode. Our guest this week hails from a small mountain town in California, but his music has now made it across the world. Jay Buchanan got his start in the early 2000s with a solo project before joining ranks with a rock band and forming Rival Sons. Since 2008, that group has built a remarkable fan base and beloved discography. Rival Sons has shared stages with an astonishing list of artists, including Black Sabbath, The Rolling Stones, AC/DC, Guns N' Roses, Queens of the Stone Age, Metallica, and Lenny Kravitz. They've appeared on The Late Late Show with James Corden, Jimmy Kimmel Live, later with Jules Holland, and France's Le Grand Journal. The band earned two Grammy nominations in 2020 for Best Rock Album for Feral Roots and Best Rock Performance for Too Bad. The Guardian called Buchanan a revelation and a mesmerizing presence throughout. Revolver called him an undeniable vocal force. And Classic Rock praised his 2026 solo debut, Weapons of Beauty, as a remarkable journey through soul music, country rock, southern gothic, and gospel. I got a chance to catch up with him a few weeks ago to hear about that solo album and his remarkable musical journey so far. Jay Buchanan of Rival Sons and of your own solo work, thanks so much for being a part of The Working Songwriter. You grew up in California, but not just, you know, standard 1970s, 80s, and 90s kind of suburban California. I was checking you out today. You grew up in kind of a more rural part of California, Wrightwood. Is that where it was from?
Yeah, Wrightwood's my hometown. You know, I grew up, when as a really young child, I lived in Fontana, which is like a recovering steel town in the Inland Empire, like San Bernardino County.
East a steel of, town in California?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And, that's wild.
By the time when I was a little kid, a lot of the factory jobs and everything were drying up, as happens in steel towns. No steel town lasts forever. So
no.
But then that's when I was a really young kid. And then my parents moved us up to the woods up in Wrightwood. And from there, it was just a lot of outdoor living, hiking, really dangerous stuff. Yeah. Tons of wildlife and all of that. And then ultimately we lived about 2 miles, mile and a half back on a dirt road. And we finished a house out there and pretty isolated, man. And but it was a great way to grow up.
It sounds like it was very isolated. What kind of cultural stuff was making it to you? Were you just kind of in contact with the outside world via TV and radio, or were you listening to records, or what?
Well, I mean, I went to school, you know, and right. You had to take a bus, walk all the way out on that dirt road out to the highway. And wow. Then, and then we would get on a bus and I don't know, it'd be like a 45 minute bus ride down to the wow. desert and go to school. But, you know, in terms of culture, just the regular stuff, man, you know, it's like skateboarding, of course, at that time, and snowboarding in the wintertime.
Sure.
It was a very young sport at that time. Snowboarding was, but my pop would, because he was a master welder, he would take jobs at the local hill in exchange for us to have season passes. So he would he would work on weekends in order for us to be able to get passes, because, you know, skiing or snowboarding stuff, it's pretty expensive, and we didn't have a lot of bread. That I was really thankful that he did all of that so that we could, you know, hang with and be on the hill with some of our more affluent friends and neighbors, you know.
Yeah. So what kind of music came along with that kind of skateboarding and snowboarding culture?
Terrible music for the most part.
Just no FX.
And it was just, you know, I mean, you know, there was DC hardcore, and there was like, you know, the Descendants, and you know, on the half pipes and all of that, there would be always Metallica. And I could never really match the energy for this music, you know. Melody and all of this stuff. I was the dork that, like, you know, if I brought tapes to there, it was like, you know, the Free Will of Bob Dylan or Tracy Chapman. It's like everybody there always like, turn that shit off. Don't let Jay put any music on.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sort of a thing. But the really aggressive nature of like hardcore and all of that, it was fun. But ultimately for me, it was novelty, and it was really more like that's what my friends were into, you know. Yeah. And I was really into songwriting from a really young age, and lyrics mattered a lot. And
really?
Yeah, they did. And so for me, talking, you know, if you want to get to like the origins. Yeah. Of music for me, and like that taproot and what it's comprised of, I guess, and, you know, blues music, you know, like that Robert Johnson collection, that everybody had. We had those cassettes when I was a little kid. And, but even beyond that, you know, it was like my parents had a huge record collection when I was really young. And then they got religion right about the time I was 5 years old. And so from 0 to 5, it was records and parties and live music, you know, on the weekends and jam sessions and all of that. And then the record collection went away, and it was just god-awful worship music. And it was, you know, and it was just kind of like, well, where did that other stuff go? And at that time, the idea of like secular music, it seemed so weird. I remember I couldn't bring myself to think that music was wrong or that there was anything wrong with it, because I had already identified with so much of it. The Joni Mitchell and the Jimi Hendrix and all of these different records, you know, that they just seemed like those were the cartoons I wanted to watch.
Yeah.
And so then, as it often does, that brand of, you know, that style of religion that swept through the United States in the late 70s, just in time for Reagan to just pick that ripe fruit off the tree. Mm-hmm. 1980. You know, that evangelical sweep that was obviously a huge response to the excess of the 70s. You know, mm-hmm. I think that these kids that had been raised in the Eisenhower era were repenting in some strange way, you know, wanting to get back to simpler times because they lacked the gumption to follow through with this mystic ideology, right? Mm. So anyways, music trickled back in as I got a little bit older, and I would spend all of any allowance, or, you know, I'd go and mow lawns for neighbors and things like that, and or just do whatever chores I could. All of my music went to cassette tapes.
Yeah.
And because that's where it was at. So I would sit and listen to these tapes. I would sit and listen. I'd go to my aunt and uncle's houses. I'd borrow their tapes. I'd listen to their records. And anytime I made new friends, it was like, do your parents listen to records? Do your parents have music? So I'd want to go. And they'd be like, dude, let's go outside and like play army or just do whatever. Right. Let's go skate. And I'd be like, no, I want to, can we just sit and listen to your parents' records for like 40 minutes or something like that? And then we'll go out. And of course, I've developed very sticky fingers around those fruits, you know? And so I would nick tapes and things like that. And I would bring them home and I would dub them.
And I just remember that.
Add to my collection, man.
And I remember that.
There was a lot of that, you know, it was the singer-songwriter aspect. I think Dylan was a huge one. But by the time I was about 11 or 12, I had a literature teacher who he could see, like, all I cared about was records and music. And so he started dubbing vinyl that he had at home, and he gave me the entire, he started me off chronologically on Bob Dylan stuff. And I had remembered all of the Bob Dylan from when I was a kid. So he did that. And then he also gave me Jimi Hendrix chronologically. And then Otis Redding, same thing chronologically. And that was a huge one for me. But yeah, singer-songwriters, man, that's really where it was at.
You mentioned that songwriting itself came very early on. That's kind of unique because many people will come onto this show and they'll describe listening to music at this age, and then they'll be like, and then 15 years later, when I was 23, I decided to try to write a song myself. It's less common than you would think for the songwriting to start early. What form was that taking at such a young age, and how are you doing it?
Well, I try to play guitar. We always had a guitar laying around the house, you know, because my pop was a fantastic guitarist, and he would play in church. My mom would sing in church. And so. So for me, I would always try to play guitar, but like, man, you know, a high action, beat up acoustic guitar with just torn to shit steel strings, like, you got to have some grabbers to be able to navigate any of that. And so I had to wait for my hands to develop before I could even really play guitar. Otherwise, I would just sit there and I would play bass notes on the low E or A string. And but by the time I could actually form chords, I mean, you know, I was 12 years old and I had been trying to play. And so I started... the only thing my pop showed me how to play was a few of the box chords, you know?
Yeah.
I remember like G major was like the first one. And then, you know, A and things like that. And he listened to Fast Car from Joni Mitchell and goes, it might be something. Well, here's how the chorus goes. And then I taught myself how to play the rest of the song.
Yeah.
And but he just showed me those couple of box chords, and immediately, as soon as I had a couple of chords, I just started writing. Huh. And boy, I wrote some real terrible music for about 10 years.
Yep, that's how it goes.
Just really, really bad. Isn't it interesting when you grow up and your collection, like your Encyclopedia Britannica. Everything that you know and the way that you view what life is and the way adults are comes through the lyrics of these scorned lovers or these dope addicts, and you know, with and all of this experience that these songwriters are singing about. And it was like, that's how I thought everything was always getting cheated on or a failed relationship. Or, you know, like all of this stuff, like that was living. And so for me as a little kid, I'm trying to write about like all these grown-up experiences, you know, and all of this like seedy living. And man, I didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. I had no idea about anything. But you write about this stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's what all of your heroes wrote about, you know? I can't, yeah, you know.
I can remember being that age and starting trying to write and realizing that all the artists that I loved had horrible relationships with their father.
Exactly.
But I had a great relationship and still
exactly.
So I had a very similar, it took till about my mid-20s where it was like, no, you can actually just write about your own experience. And actually, that's the only thing that you can write about. And maybe that'll work for you or it won't, but that's really the only thing that's going to be authentic. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is very interesting. And just writing about all of that stuff and then busking. And I paid my hardcore dues for about 2 years because the only kids, you know, the only people up in my tiny mountain town that wanted to play music at all, they wanted to play hardcore.
Right.
Power chords and energy. And like, you know, I definitely understood that. But then I would try to bring like an acoustic guitar in, try to actually write melodic songs. And that was problematic. And so I just found it easier to just play on my own.
Yeah. And so when did you know at that time, like, man, this is going to be a path for me. I'm going the music route. Or was it just something that you were doing that you dug as a kid and it could have gone many different directions?
I think it works like this, man. Like, first of all, kids, we don't even understand path.
Right.
You know, like we understand now, you know, that's how things work for kids and planning right. and all of that. Like you lack the patience, you know, it's like when somebody, they talk to you about going like, okay, well, as soon as you graduate, you're going to go off and go to college for a few years. And you're like, 4 years?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Why would I go anywhere for 4 years? You know? And it's like, what I did know was that the idea of doing anything else with my life just felt like jail.
Yeah.
You know? And like, it just seemed like jail. I would watch my pop come home from the steel mill. And he'd play his guitar. If he was working a day shift, you know, he'd come home in the evening or the afternoon and, he would take a shower and everything and he would sit and he'd play his guitar for an hour, 40 minutes. And I'd watch him play. And there was always this like, caged bird mentality that his music sounded like, you know? And I would tell him when he would come home, I would say, so did, because my pop's name is Jay as well. And I would say, so when you go to work, you're job Jay. And then when you come home, you're home Jay. And he'd be like, yep. And I'd be like, so you never bring job Jay home? He'd be like, not if I can help it, you know. And I would watch home Jay sit and play his guitar, you know, and because he played in bands and all that stuff. And in so many ways, my desire to tap into all of this, I think, was just to live out my parents' unrequited dreams.
Hmm.
You know, there was my love for music, but there was also like, I got my love and I got everything I have from my lineage. You know, both of my grandmothers sang. Had fantastic voices. My mother has a fantastic voice. And music is in my family. And I felt like I needed to become successful enough to get the big record deal. Mind you, this is like in the 90s when big record deals existed and everything.
Sure, sure.
But my dream was to get enough money in my pocket to walk to that steel mill and tell my pop, like, let's go.
Yeah.
You're never coming back. That's all I wanted. That was all I wanted at that young age. But writing from, you know, watching people and watching adults be so unhappy and talk about their jobs, and watching these teachers and having these instructors and these teachers that were obviously rife with unrequited everything, it just told me, like, you might as well play music. Music is, you know, I didn't want to be connected to anything else. Music was like the sacred language. That was the one where you had to tell the truth. You had to tell the truth if you're singing. You had to tell the truth. Because if you're not telling the truth, it sounds like a sales pitch.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, as a little kid, you could always spot the sales pitch. And it's like, well, don't be one of those. Just be one of these other guys. You know, just now, singing about your feelings or whatever.
I know you started performing from a young age, and you had several bands that you formed in your teens and early 20s, but your first crack at really basically that dream of yours of like, I want to get a deal and I want to be successful here, because back in the day, the deal was the only way to do it. That would obviously come, actually, I think you had a deal before Rival Sons even. What was that band? Yeah.
Yeah. The name of the band was Buchanan. Mm-hmm. I had my, okay, so side quest here.
Side quest.
I had turned 20. I was living in San Bernardino with a girlfriend across from the university over there. And she was going and finishing up her master's. And I was just working and playing coffee shops. And I was miserable. So I sold everything I had. And I went and I did the thing. I went backpack through Alaska. And I wanted to find my country. I was all hopped up on the Beat Poets, and, you know, and like Jack London and like the whole thing, and just going like, I'm going to go out there and hitchhike and live like a vagabond for a few months and like do the thing. Mm-hmm. So I went and I did that, and I grew up, and I went out there, and a couple of buddies came with me. And when I came home, it was like, okay, I just went and I moved down into the city. Because you can't make a career living in the woods. That's for sure.
Right.
I moved down to the city, down to Orange County. And just started writing. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any friends. And next thing I know, I'm with a gal. And we were together for about a month. We find out we're going to be parents. Well, let's get married. Okay, let's try this out. You know, we were in love. Even though we hadn't been dating for very long. And I got, as soon as the baby came, it was like, okay, I had already started writing what would become like my very first record. So that was I was at 22 then. And I didn't have an audience. And so I was writing these songs. And so I just started hitting open mic nights, you know. And I hit a few of those and people started really reacting. So then I saw that and I thought, you know, I don't want to wait for an open mic night. And so I started doing this thing of throwing a small acoustic amp that you could plug the microphone into. You know, those SWR working man's, or not the working man, but the California Blonde, mm-hmm. You know. They made the Strawberry Blonde, but at that time, the California Blonde was the best acoustic amp I could get my hands on. And so I'd go with that with like a 50-foot extension cord, and I wouldn't ask. I would just set up a microphone and an amp and play until I got kicked out. And I would sell burned copies of my CDs. And I did that, and I called them guerrilla gigs. And then I got a buddy of mine on guitar to start coming with me. And we'd hit like 7, 8 places, sometimes 10 places a night, anywhere people were, if there was a movie premiere, whatever. So I did that. And then within 3 months of doing that, I was on the cover of the local rag. Yeah. And then, you know, a couple months later, manager got a full band together. And like, within a year, I was on top of the Capitol Records building.
Wow.
And that's right when like AOL bought Warner out, and that was that first huge merge in 99. And so I ended up going with an independent label, Ultimatum, and I had a band. I reframed the band, and it was called Buchanan, because I felt weird about being calling the band J.B. Cannon because it was a band. And so I cheated by just naming it my last name. How clever. And I made an album called All Understood. And toured coast to coast. You know, I did that. Toured coast to coast and put out independently two more albums with that band, the True Love EP. Or no, it was just the True Love EP. And then broke the band up in 06.
Wow.
Broke the band up in 06. And, you know, we'd had a lot of success. But it was the classic thing of waking up one day and not liking anything I had done. And listening to my creative output and just going, this isn't what I want to do. There's too much going on. I had seen Andrew Bird over at Largo when he was doing like the Fingerlings albums. That you, if you haven't heard this, I mean, you know, everybody knows Andrew Bird and he's fantastic, you know. Mm. But he put out these live recordings where it's just him and his loop station, his violin, the guitar. Fingerlings 1 and 2 are exquisite, fantastic songwriting, and just a singular presence that I hadn't seen before. So I saw this guy, and it really wrecked me, you know. And this was in 06. It really, really destroyed me. And I thought, well, that is a hell of a lot closer to what I want to do than what I'm doing. So I got to stop what I'm doing. So I broke that band up and took a construction job and took the hard drive with the band's email list and all of our physical stuff. Took the, what was that? MySpace, took the MySpace page, dumped it, and just completely broke everything so hard that it couldn't be fixed.
What did that feel like at the time? Did it feel like failure or did it feel like a new beginning?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It felt like failure and a new beginning. But it was one of those things where I knew something was inside me that I hadn't been saying. And I knew that there was approach. There was an approach that was more mature or that was just closer to... that was closer to who I was at that point, as opposed to being part of a band and needing to identify with the people I was playing with and like all of that. So everybody told me it was career suicide and they scattered. And in the meantime, I worked construction and kept writing. And then within a year, I had a batch of songs. I went in and recorded them. And began working on what was an album called Locust and Wild Honey. And this was to be my rebirth as an artist. And recorded this album, felt really good about it. And then I took on a side project with a rock and roll band. And I figured it'll be fun to have some drinks and play some gigs around town. And why not? I had never done rock and roll in my life. And I actually had kind of an aversion to it.
Yeah.
And I thought, why not? Why not? You know, I didn't take it seriously. And that took off like a rocket. And so that magnum opus of Locust and Wild Honey sits unreleased to this day.
It'll get out one day. It'll get out. Do you think there is something to the fact that you quote unquote didn't take it seriously that allowed you to create in kind of a freer way?
Oh, I think that perhaps that was, I think that was just the universe hitting me and poking me in a soft spot in a certain way. Like, oh, you don't take this seriously. Well, watch this.
Yeah.
Because when we got together and jammed, I had no intention of doing it at all. Because I knew the drummer, Michael Miley, and he had played in my band for just a little bit in Buchanan. Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, my guitar player, Scott, is really convinced that we need to play together, you know. And he said, will you just call Scott so he'll get off my back? And I said, sure. And Scott's a really great talker. and I had grown up on the blues. I had grown up on blues music. And so we talked, and I just figured, like, okay, well, let's get together and jam. The energy in the room when we finally got together was such that it was like, ah, man, I don't need this right now. I don't have time for this. I have a whole thing that I'm trying to do, and I'm really excited about it. But the energy was there, and so it was really like, I can't not do this. So let's try it.
Well, and it sounds like it was kind of a gift, because you had been doing, you had been creating for long enough at that point to know that when an energy like that is present, it's a very rare thing. And it's
certainly,
it's not one that you let go by lightly, even if it isn't the pet project that you expected it to be. So luckily you were seasoned enough to not let that, I mean, maybe if that had happened to you when you were 22, you would have thought, oh yeah, well, this sounds great. And then the next project I do will sound great. And then the next one. And it just simply didn't work like that.
No, it never comes. Like any great story, it's the beggar on the roadside that the protagonist interfaces with, you know, that's going to end up being his teacher.
Yeah.
You know, it's the little green man in Star Wars that's going to teach Luke the goods and the force. And it was a very unlikely education. I think perhaps the greatest thing that I've learned by collaborating and putting myself in this genre that I never had any intention of being in, and then enjoying, is compromise, is putting myself in a position to, okay, we're going to be a band. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stick it out. And looking at it and just going, okay, I am going to compromise here. We're a band. So as much as I wanted to do this, or I wanted the music to be this way, we're still a band, and there are other identities here. It's not just mine. And so I have to keep, I have to keep these people in mind, and I have to make sure when I'm writing a song to leave enough room to not do their job, to not do my guitar player's job, or, you know, and to think of the overall identity, you know, instead of just mine. So what my job is all of the lyrics and, you know, primary songwriting and everything. I'll do my job. But everybody else's job is just up to them. And I think that that is the power of collaboration, that gives you something that's ultimately greater than the sum of its parts on a good day. on a good day.
Did you find it then easier to write songs because the whole burden wasn't on your shoulders, or was it actually strangely more difficult because even though you didn't have all that weight on your shoulders, compromise can be very hard, especially if you've been used to creating for several decades on your own?
I think I found it insanely more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because suddenly, if I'm handed a song, if I'm handed this music, it's like, man, bombastic drums, screaming guitar riffs, high energy. It's like, what? That's not okay. So I need to get into this mindset, and I need to live in this mindset. Am I going to live at a permanent midnight on a Saturday? Right? Is this where I'm at? Is everything going to be high octane? Oh my God. And next thing I know, I'm screaming on every song. I'm competing with these loud volumes to be an instrument within this wall of sound. And initially it was more of one of these things like, can I do this? I'm going to do this. Watch, hold my beer. I'm going to do this thing. I'm not going to back down from this. And I think that initially it was very much like that until I was able to establish myself and understand myself within the genre and understand that, look, I don't have to play to these unrequited dreams of these rock journalists and like this dumb shit lifestyle. That doesn't have to be me. I can just be myself amidst all of these things and just focus on that. Just focus on attempt to stay myself and try to write about things that are important to me. Even though the music is doing this, I can still try to do this. And I would do that every now and again. That's not to say that I don't understand the value in ooh, baby.
Right.
I know, sometimes I need that. And I think that this education and understanding and getting the value of sometimes I'm going to write songs where it's just more about the energy and it's not about the lyrics. What?
Yeah.
You know, it's actually true. It's all right, man. Lue.
Right.
You know?
Well, that marriage that you're talking about right there that you had to put together, I would have to guess, I will hazard a guess, that if George Martin was the fifth Beatle, Dave Cobb has obviously played that role with you guys. How did Dave help with that marriage between what you're doing lyrically and spiritually, frankly, and what the band is doing musically?
Dave is I don't know. I feel like Dave might be my evil twin in some ways, but we're like I trust Dave, you know, and he, from the very beginning, he just has a fantastic ear. I mean, everybody knows that Dave is insanely talented. He's really good at what he does. He's not a polished producer. He's just looking for the straight dope, and that's it, you know, from any time you're in the studio.
Well, and you said everybody knows, but at the time when you first started working with him, not everybody knew that. I mean,
everybody knows now.
They know now, but not back then.
Everybody knows now. All I knew was he had a very discerning ear, and I didn't like doing a bunch of takes, and I wanted to sound as live as possible. And Dave was right in line with that ethos, and so we would make our records that way. We would go in with nothing and I would just chain myself to the desk and have a nervous breakdown for a week, having to write and write and write and write and write and record a song as soon as it's written, the second it's ready, just go in there and do it in front of everybody. And it was a hair-raising experience, but we did that record after record, and it certainly shaped me, and it gave me, by putting myself in that sort of a situation, it allowed me an opportunity to sharpen and develop instinct in that regard, you know?
When you say develop instinct, do you mean it allowed you to just make decisions a lot faster and trust those decisions, or what do you mean exactly?
And to improvise, and to write on the spot, you know, and to just improvise and not take it, not be too precious, and to kill your darlings, and to fully employ, I'm about to offend people in certain states, but to fully employ creative abortion.
Yeah, just getting rid of the things that are holding you back.
Yes, creatively. It's not the things that are holding you back necessarily, but yeah, consider songs and consider works of art. Sometimes it may not be strong enough to live in the world and live in the wild without you. And if it isn't, kill it, you know, and try to keep a very healthy flock that way. If it's limping around and if it's a song that isn't strong enough, just let it go. Even if you really like it, well, can you make it work? Well, then get rid of it, because everything that lives here has got to be healthy and it's got to be strong. and it has to be able to survive in the ring. Otherwise, just get rid of it.
Well, and there's also just, there's limited resources when you're working on a creative project. And I find it's like, well, I can spend 4 hours making this kind of crappy song slightly less crappy, or I can spend 4 hours with an entirely new idea and actually have a chance at a good song. And I just couldn't agree with you more. Like, I have no interest in polishing turds. I used to, when I was younger, waste a lot of time polishing turds. It's a weird form of procrastination, I think. And yeah, I'm kind of more with your ethos that you're describing there now.
I get it. And moving on and hitting, just pulling the lever on that creative slot machine again.
That's a great way to describe it. Yeah.
You might get all cherries, man. You don't know. But if you stay focused on something that is not working, oftentimes it'll be a puzzle that reveals itself, but then other times you're actually just groping at someone who doesn't want to be groped at all.
Yeah.
You know?
So talk to me about, this most recent record that you just sent me, Weapons of Beauty, which I love. This sounds like, you know, you mentioned, what was it, the record that never came out, Locust and Honey? Was that it?
Locust and Wild Honey.
Locust. This sounds like, now that I've listened to this record sounds like what you described that record that never came out as. Would that be a good guess?
Well, that album sits, I'll probably release that Locust and Wild Honey next year, or I don't know, before too long, but I needed to establish myself as a solo artist before letting that album get out there. And so I went into the desert, you know, on some off time, and from, I guess, January to April of 25. And I just lived in an underground bunker for a few months and had to try to find that solo writer that doesn't need to compromise or collaborate.
Yeah.
And develop the discipline to finish a song and to stay with it. But this, you know, this album, Weapons of Beauty, it was really just, it's the sound of me just opening the birdcage and waiting for the bird to fly out, you know, because it took a long time. It took a lot of staring at the wall in this underground bunker in the desert. It took a lot of just waiting and waiting to be inspired and wasting time and sleeping on a cot and eating from a camping stove and getting electricity from a little gas generator I brought out there. But I think it was the sound of me trying to find myself and grant permission for that bird to fly out, you know, and for that part of myself to get out of the cage and start walking around.
Did you have to disconnect from digital technology as well at that time to be able to just let yourself get bored?
No, I didn't. I didn't have to because, depriving yourself is still giving technology the power, you know? But for me, like, I'm a father and a husband. And, you know, so for me, like, my cell phone didn't work down in the bunker. But I worked and recorded everything. You know, I would demo on my computer under there. And I'd have to flip the generator on and set it up and do all of that. But I think the training myself as I'm there to... training myself to be all right with wasting time instead of like just staying there with my hand on my fishing pole. Like there could be a tug on the line any second. Stay there. I think being okay with wasting my time became very important. It became a very important lesson because you don't know the time is really yours. unless you can waste it. That's when it's your time. And I think that being okay with going out and going for a hike, or, you know, going and walking around in the gold mines that were over there where I was at, and doing that sort of a thing. You can't always be living this like romantic, I'm so inspired and poetic ethos when you're out there. You know, you can have all of the accoutrement, and you can have the right books, and you can have your journals, you know, the right kind of scotch, or just the right everything. And that doesn't mean the muse is going to show up at all. You know, it's like you can, there's no such thing as a successful rain dance when it comes to these sort of things that I've ever found. And it's about, I think the accumulative exposure might have been the greatest asset of all in staying there and remembering of what I'm there to do. Because I would come back. I would come back from staying out there 7-8 nights, and I'd come home to be with my family for 2 nights. My wife would be like, "Hey, so how did it go?" I'd be like, "I didn't write a goddamn thing. I didn't write anything." And you talk about feeling like a failure, you know? Like a, you know, here I'm a 49-year-old father out there, nothing. I got nothing. And you feel frustrated, but I just had to stay with it, you know? And that's, there's a song like High and Lonesome that's on the record that's very much about that, you know? That, you know, the staying, how many times have you stayed up extra late, you know, or had too much to drink, staying up too late, just waiting a good idea might come.
Yeah. And we're not in a widget making business where it's like you don't get paid if the factory line isn't putting out widgets. We're in a thing of if you rack that machine and get all cherries, that will pay for your next 10 years type of business. You know what I mean? So you got to be focused on that racking of the machine when you can. And as long as it takes, that's how it takes. It's not a linear input and output type of business.
No, it's a prospector's lifestyle.
Prospector. There you go. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no 401k, man.
I'm starting to learn that. That's really hitting home at age 41 here. That really is hitting home. Prospector's lifestyle. And I guess the other thing that prospectors had to worry about was someone stabbing them by the fire as they slept after the big score, which there's aspects of the music business that go along with that as well.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I was right up in the mountains, like where really I was in the mountain system where like Treasure, the Sierra Madre and all of that, you know, took place.
That is wild. Are you now looking forward to? I can imagine going through a season like that, and as hard as it is to write with Rival Sons, where you're in a room, everyone's waiting for you, you're going to come out and just cut a song for the first time that you've ever sang it in front of a bunch of people. I'd imagine after this season of writing in kind of a solo way, you might actually be chomping at the bit to do that again, right, in that other manner.
Yes and no. I mean, I think that, you know, life throwing me some curveballs, like at this very moment, I think, I miss my friends, and I'm looking forward to like sharing and getting that collaborative energy. So yes, but the idea, like I'm doing some writing right now. I'm trying to in my spare time. I'm not altogether sure what is going to come out, you know, or like what this next Rival Sons record is going to be like. I don't know about that. And I think that also because I'm so preoccupied with other things at the present moment that there is some trepidation there, you know, like where's it going to come from? Because I mean, like what we just talked about, until it exists, like, man, I don't know for sure if that's going to show up. Yeah. There's always that thing of like, is there any more left in there?
Yes. Yeah. You know. Oh man, but when it works, you know, one of the things I find, I've listened to so much music in my life, and sometimes I'll be driving home and I want to put on a song and I'm like, I'm so bored of all this stuff that I listen to. The song that I want to listen to doesn't exist yet. And then you go back the next day and maybe you're in the studio and you freaking write it. and you wrote that song and it didn't exist. And then as you drive home on that day, you pull up your little demo file, you put it into the car stereo, and now you can listen to the song that you wanted to hear yesterday. And it didn't exist, in the world for 24 hours beforehand. I mean, you know, for all of the waiting that has to happen and all the boredom and the shame in some ways that we both described, like, man, that feeling of being able to listen to the song that you just wrote that didn't exist 24 hours before, that's as high as it can get as an adult, I think.
Well, you need those wins in order to carry on.
Yeah.
You know, like when they train these, they train the search and rescue dogs up in the Alps. You know, the old cartoon with the dog with the brand ear, the schnapps, you know, under there.
Yeah.
But when they train the avalanche dogs, when they're training these dogs, they have to plant a survivor every now and then, because the dogs get depressed and they lose heart.
Yeah.
And because they need a win, and we're the same way, you know.
Yeah.
The dogs get depressed and they can no longer keep training. They can't learn, you know, or they'll stop looking because they get too bummed. I mean, nobody wants to think about a sad dog, a depressed dog. Like, few things are sadder. But I mean, for us as riders in this prospector's lifestyle, you just want to know that there's enough water to get you and your horse to the next mission.
Yeah.
You know, and just knowing that, getting a win, nothing feels like that. And when you've done it enough times, you trust it. And I think that, like with this last record, for me staying out there so long, getting some of the songs that I did, it was a pretty terrifying experience. You know, there was more doubt than I thought that I could endure. You know, there was a lot of high dive jitters there going on. And the reflection and the isolation and like everything, I was able to get a result. I was able to get just enough.
Yeah.
Just enough to make a record, because when I left the desert and I had to fly to Savannah and record this record, we recorded it over 5 days, and all the way over there, I was nervous as could be. And I mean, you know, what have I made, like 15, 16 records in my life already? But I was just about terrified, because of what I had done was so personal and it was so close to the bone. I hadn't shared it with anyone. And I wasn't convinced that any of it was worth a damn, or that anybody would relate to it at all. You know, I didn't show Cobb. I didn't show anybody. And, you know, Dave Macias gave me a little distribution deal in order to pay for things and, you know, with 30 Tigers and get the record going. He didn't even hear it, you know. Mm-hmm. He just, thankfully, he believed it. He had faith in me. But I mean, just getting in there, and I remember recording the very first song, I was so nervous. I was so nervous. I think I meditated like 3 times upstairs, just trying to get the courage to show the band the first song.
Yeah.
And also not look terrified, you know, not look scared that, you know, that I was going to fail. But it's interesting how those things work, man.
Man, well, it's after having heard the record and now hearing your experience of making it like that, it's heartening to listen to as another writer, because it just comes off as such a great record. And if you would have asked me beforehand, I would have been like, yeah, he wrote all those songs out in the desert. He knew it was a smash, and it was just a party getting to go record them. But it feels good to know that you were sweating it. Listen, man, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time with everything that's going on with you right now. And just thank you so much, Jay.
I appreciate what you do, Joe. And, your podcast is fantastic, because it's for writers by writers.
Yeah,
and
man.
It's very refreshing, man.
Thank you.
Oh, and real quick, shout out to let's see, Joe Firstman and BJ Barham for turning me onto your stuff. It was BJ and Joe and I in a van back in 08, somewhere around there. And yeah,
I love both those guys so much. And Joe, I mean, all that stuff, obviously I've been a fan of BJ's for years, but Joe's stuff with the Cordovas, I think that the record is called That Santa Fe Channel. I love that record so much.
Yeah. This town's a drag.
Yeah. I think Brian Wright wrote that song. It's a great song.
Yeah. Brian's a great writer, but, just shout out to them. You write great songs. Been a long time fan, Joe.
Thank you, man. This week's show is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Built by musicians and for musicians, Bandzoogle is an all-in-one platform to build a beautiful website for your music. Use promo code TWS, the initials of our podcast, TWS, to get 15% off the first year of any new subscription. Jay Buchanan's latest album is entitled Weapons of Beauty, available everywhere music is sold or streamed. If before we meet again, you sit down to write, please remember, an expensive drug habit is not a song, a compelling Instagram account is not a song, and most importantly, reverb is not a song. So let all that take care of itself, and for you, just keep your eye on the song.